When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once, new quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is episode 121 of VRP Rocks, the ultimate classic rock podcast that says that my music is better than yours. Make sure to subscribe to VRP Rocks on your podcast app right now so you don't miss a single episode. They come out each Monday. Now, today I interview a fascinating drummer who is also an artist. Or should that be an artist who is also a drummer? Well, we'll delve into that, of course. On the rock music front, he is the current drummer for Lynyrd Skynyrd, has been for 26 years. He was part of the brilliant supergroup featuring Tommy Shaw, Ted Nugent and Night Ranger's Jack Blades, the Damn Yankees. He's worked on music with legends like Freddie Mercury, John Wetton, Joe Lynn Turner, Peter Frampton, Vince Neil, Accept and Blue Oyster Cult's Joe Bouchard, among many, many others. I am talking about the drummer Michael Cartellone. And as I said at the start, he's also an artist and has created some amazing artwork, some rock-themed, including a ridiculously good one of the Beatles and Lynyrd Skynyrd too. His artistic side goes back further than his rock music side. You could say he was a child prodigy, perhaps. He has a new exhibition in Asheville, North Carolina on May 25th, so if you're in the area, please do go and check it out, and I dare say you'll get to meet the man himself as well. But in this interview, we're going to kick off with his love of art and then, of course, talk about his life in Skynyrd, their current tour with ZZ Top. We talk about the Damn Yankees as well and his time in that supergroup, the influence Ron Neverson has had on his career and some of those incredible projects he worked on with the people I mentioned earlier from his incredible resume too. So here you go. Please enjoy this fun conversation with Michael Cartellone. Thank you so much for joining me as we speak. You are in a hotel room preparing for a gig tonight because you're on tour at the moment with Lynyrd Skynyrd, partnering up with ZZ Top. And as you were just telling me, you can actually see the venue from your window.
I sure can. I've been watching the trucks back up to the loading docks and the crew walking in and out of the building, having their breakfast. And I normally don't get this vantage point, but it's kind of fun to see it.
And we'll get onto that very shortly indeed, but we mentioned the painting and the art side of your life, and that is something that's very important to you, and it's something that began a long time ago. It began before the music, in fact, and you were on an art college or an art course from a really young age, and we're talking kindergarten, aren't we?
Indeed. I was 4 years old, and the kindergarten teacher had seen my interest in painting and had mentioned something to my parents that they may want to encourage that. And how wonderful that teacher did that, honestly. So the summer in between kindergarten and first grade, when I was 4 years old, my parents enrolled me in a course at the Cleveland Institute of Art, Cleveland, Ohio, which is where I'm from. And that began my journey as a visual artist. And the drumming began when I was 9, at which point then the music and the art became two halves of a whole. And really, they have coexisted my entire life to the degree where I have trouble separating the two in my head, because they balance each other, they enhance, they support each other. It would be hard for me to imagine just doing one and not the other, because they're completely connected.
Yeah. And it's not just you. I mean, especially here in the UK, a lot of rock stars from the 60s and 70s, they went to art college. It's something that does seem to go hand in hand with music.
Absolutely. Peter Frampton is one of my longtime friends. And his father actually was an art instructor.
Indeed.
And Bowie was one of his students.
Very true. We had Peter on recently, and he was telling that story of how they got together and played music and everything else, as well as doing the outside of it all. So fascinating stuff. So let's jump to now then, because obviously you've spent a long time doing music. You've spent a lot of time doing art as well. And as well as doing just the paintings and doing it for your own benefit, you also put on exhibitions, and you've got an exhibition that's coming up very soon, haven't you?
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. May 25 in Asheville, North Carolina, I am doing an art opening with a very talented artist named Philip D'Angelo. And Phil has his own gallery in Asheville, very well-established, successful painter in that area. And he and I met, and we hit it off because we learned that we both had a shared Sicilian ancestry.
Okay.
So based off of that, we've created this body of work where we've done paintings that reflect our shared history. And the show is called Bella Italia, beautiful Italy. And it happens at his gallery in the River Arts District, which is a really cool area in the Asheville. And it's really going to be a great event because we have very different styles in the way we paint. So even though we're going to do some of the same subject matter, it's going to have a very different look, because you're going to see it from two different vantage points.
Fascinating stuff. And in terms of what people will see, what are they expecting to see if they come along to this exhibition?
They will see half of the gallery of his work, half of the gallery of my work, although we'll intermix them. So you can see how they play off of each other. We have chosen specifically one subject matter that we're each painting, and it is an ancient Greek amphitheater that was built in 300 AD, and it's in a Sicilian town called Taormina, because I have family in Sicily that I've gone down to visit. And this Greek theater, both Philip and I are painting it. And those two paintings will hang side by side right in the middle of the gallery as a way of kind of having our two worlds meet, as it were. There are several other Italian and or Sicilian paintings that that I've done that will be there, as well as there are a handful of music-themed paintings to just kind of round out the vocabulary a little bit. There is a painting that I've titled 50, and it is the seven original Lynyrd Skynyrd members from the first album that came out in 1973, hence the 50th, anniversary name. That painting will be at the show. And another one that I'm immensely proud of, and I should preface this by saying I am a lifelong Beatles fanatic. And of course, Ringo is my favorite drummer. I did a painting which will be at the show in Asheville, and it is called Ringo. And this painting is what Ringo saw sitting behind the drums and looking out in January 1969 on the rooftop in London. So you see the three Beatles in front of him. You see the skyline of London beyond that. And you, the viewer, are Ringo. You see what he saw. I spent a full year working on that painting because I left nothing to chance. To the degree that I researched the brick and mortar pattern across the road, so it would be perfect. And I'm very, very proud of that painting.
And where did the idea for that? Because it's an interesting concept, because when you think of a painting of the Beatles, you expect to see the faces, the front of them. But as you said, this is from Ringo's perspective, and you see the back of their heads, the back of their bodies, and then the street opposite and the skyline as well. Yeah. So where did the idea of the concept come from for that?
Well, as you might guess, I see that vantage point a lot. Yes. So literally, I was just, you know, sitting behind the drum kit one day, and I thought, I wonder what it felt like to be Ringo. You know, because I see the back of the Lynyrd Skynyrd guys every day. Well, Ringo probably saw the back of the other three. So about 15 years ago, the idea just popped in my head. Wouldn't it be fun to do that? Well, what era do I paint? And I thought, you know, it might be really interesting to paint their last live performance, which was up on top of the Apple building. And so I started researching it then. But I'm the kind of person who never stops thinking about painting ideas. And literally, I carry a list around on my phone that I keep adding to. I don't know if I'll live long enough to actually paint every one of them, but this Ringo rooftop idea has been on my phone for 15 years. But I just never got around to it because when I would finish a painting, I would then look at the phone and think, oh, I'm going to do that one now. And I would just, you know, kind of randomly choose what I would do. Until the wonderful Peter Jackson Get Back documentary came out.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. And then the light bulb went off of, oh, that painting idea. Now's the time to do it because there's this renewed interest in that era. And that movie actually was very helpful because it showed me more reference that I didn't have 15 years ago with the extra documentary footage that Peter Jackson was able to uncover. And then there, you know, there was a book that was released in conjunction with the film. And of course, I bought everything that they offered, like a good Beatle fan should. And so as I mentioned, Paul, about the leaving nothing to chance, you know, the drum heads that you see in the painting look exactly like Ringo's drum heads did, with all of the little stick marks and the kind of discolored, yeah, aged look of the head. And, you know, I really spent a lot of time before I even put a paintbrush to the canvas to make sure I knew what I was going to do. Because I am not a spontaneous painter. I do not start with a canvas and see where it may take me. I may sketch, plan, go to museums, look at other work for inspiration, should it need be inspired. And I'm very, very calculating in the way I've painted all these years.
And just quickly, in terms of that painting in particular, I mean, what sort of size is it for those of us that aren't going to be able to get along to this exhibition to see it in person? How big is it? Is it sort of Mona Lisa size, or are we talking grand scale?
Forgive my American mathematics, but it's 5 feet across and 3 feet tall.
Wow. So it's big then.
It's big. And literally, you know, there's a 12-inch drum that Ringo had directly in front of him. On the painting, the drum is 12 inches in diameter. So I made it as real as it could possibly feel.
Brilliant stuff. Well, Michael, wish you the best of luck with the exhibition. As we said, May 25th is when it's on. Some fantastic bits of art for people to see. And I'm sure it won't be the last one as well. And best of luck with all the future exhibitions going forward too.
Thank you, Paul.
No worries at all. Right, we're going to have to jump into the music. And as you said, your first love was the Beatles, and Ringo was your favorite. But I'd heard you say that kind of progressive music was where your love kind of developed. It's where it blossomed when you were kind of late teens, early 20s sort of thing. But just moving on slightly, you'd worked with Eddie Jobson, who obviously we know from the likes of UK and Curved Air and things like that. So how did you go from progressive rock and Eddie Jobson to working with Ted Nugent, Tommy Shaw, Jack Blades, and the Damn Yankees?
Yeah, that's quite the jump, isn't it?
It is indeed.
I will tell you, there's something about the British arts, be it music or visual, that I've loved all my life. So not only am I a lifelong Beatles fan, I'm a lifelong Bowie fan. It's not surprising that I would then discover the band Yes, and then UK, and all of this wonderful British progressive rock. So the shortest story that I can offer here is I had moved to New York City when I was 22 years old to work with Eddie Jobson. And we had a recording project. We weren't performing live, but we were just writing and recording a lot of songs, because he was doing a solo project called Zinc at the time. This would have been 1985. After a while, my other New York City drummer friends were starting to get tours, and I started getting very jealous because Eddie and I were just strictly doing this recording studio project. So one day I said, would you mind if I tried to find a tour? And he said, no, that would be a great experience for you to do so. And I ended up auditioning for and landing the gig playing with Tommy Shaw, who of course would then years later become my Damn Yankees collaborator. Tommy Shaw at that point had left the band Styx, was doing a solo career, and I played in Tommy's solo band for a few years.
Okay.
Although during that time, Eddie and I were still doing the recording project. So whenever I was home in New York, Eddie and I would get together and work on more recordings. And a few years later, when the Damn Yankees idea came into fruition, Tommy very graciously brought me in. That became the real baptism by fire for my career. Because I was still just, a young unknown guy. And all of a sudden I'm in this, super group with three very famous people and then one young unknown kid. But it became a wonderful experience. And I will tell you, there were times that I remember vividly during Damn Yankees where, because I had grown up loving and playing British progressive rock, left to my own devices, I'm going to start thinking along those lines, which is a different approach musically, a lot of odd time signatures. And there were times with Damn Yankees where it would just happen that I would start playing like a progressive rock drummer and I would start doing like inversion of time just because I was very comfortable doing it. And they would literally turn around and say, remember who you are playing with. Because they knew of my history with Eddie. And I've told Eddie that story, and he really got a kick out of that, by the way.
I bet. So how did it feel? Because you said yourself there that you were the unknown. I mean, you've got three guys who come from huge backgrounds and stuff. So at the time, with all the due respect in the world, it's a super group, but you were unknown. So how did it feel being part of that?
It felt like I was being given this wonderful opportunity that... I was very aware that I was very lucky to be in the right place at the right time, kind of a scenario. And I will tell you, as the process was unfolding, while we were writing songs for the first Damn Yankees record and getting ready to record that first record, the news kind of leaked out about this band forming and getting ready to record. And then phone calls started to come in from other very famous drummers in other very famous bands saying, hey, you know, I would love to play on that record. So there was a moment of time where I thought, oh yeah, you know what? I'm going to be out of here any minute now. But thankfully, Tommy Shaw, Jack Blades, Ted Nugent were very happy with what I had been doing, because by this point, we had been working, building the music for that first album for almost a full year.
Okay.
And what was happening was they were taking a young drummer who had a fair amount of skill and was coming to them saying, what do you guys need me to be? And they kind of molded me in what that drummer role in Damn Yankees needed to be. So I feel like I can, it's easier for me to look back and see that it was working. So don't fix something that isn't broken. And, it was wonderful of them to have the foresight to do that. And, you know, that first album, which now is 34 years old, yeah. I'm very proud, Paul, to say that that record continues to sell all these years later. That album made some kind of a mark with people, and people still seem to like it. And I could not be more proud of that album.
And it's not just the album, it's the band itself. People do look back fondly on the Damn Yankees, and I'm sure you get asked all the time, and I've heard you say before that you still remain friends. The four of you are all good friends. You do touch base every now and again. You never officially disbanded. You put it on pause, I think, is what you've said in the past. So would you look favorably? Would you welcome a reunion of sorts, whether that's touring or new music?
I would do it today.
you've got a concert tonight. You can't do that.
I'll do it right after our concert tonight.
That's it.
Yes, Paul. We have all stayed in touch. In fact, Ted Nugent just texted me yesterday. So we've all remained friends over the years. We have never said never. So anything is possible. But the reality is we have four very separate, very demanding careers.
Yep.
And literally to try and find a window of opportunity, even a few weeks that we're all free at the same time, has proven to be an impossibility. So it's not about the desire. It's literally just about the physical time. Can it ever happen? Because all of us would love to do it. And maybe one day we can.
One day, hopefully, because that would be fantastic. The fans would love that. Just touching on some other people from your resume then, because as we said, you've worked with some incredible people. I want to ask about John Wetton. That's a bit more back to the kind of progressive rock kind of line, isn't it? You worked with him on his second solo album, Battle Lines. I mean, what was John like to work with?
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month. So just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
John was such a wonderful man. Rest in peace.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a nice tie-in to Eddie Jobson in UK.
Yep.
Because John was Eddie's co-writer, co-founder. And the short story here is John was in Los Angeles getting ready to record Battle Lines. And I'm going to say this is 1992. Yes, it was 1992. I was living in Los Angeles, smack dab in the middle of the damn Yankees era. So very, very busy. And I get a phone call from a producer named Ron Nevison. And Ron had produced both Damn Yankee albums. Yeah. Ron is a very well-known, legendary producer. I mean, literally, you know, Ron worked on Physical Graffiti and Quadrophenia. You know, those aren't bad things to have on your resume.
A couple of small records, indeed, yeah.
Yeah, a few people have heard of those, but... So Ron called one day. He knew I was home on a tour break, and Ron knew that I was a big UK fan. And he said, hey, you know, I'm producing this record with John, and we need a drummer. And since you're home, he said, I'll hire you to do this record. I was just giddy. And the first thing I did was call Eddie Jobson and say, guess what I'm doing today? So it was a great experience. Of course, the very first thing I said to John when I met him at the studio in Los Angeles was, you know, so a few years back, I was working with Eddie. And so that was a nice little icebreaker for the two of us. And we just had a great time recording that record. Very, very proud of that one. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you, years later, John had discovered my fine artwork. And he told me, he said, there's one painting that you have that I really love. And that painting, it's an Italian themed painting. It's the carnival in Venice. So the people with the masks. And and John loved it so much that he got one of those.
Oh, wow.
And I'm happy to say that there will be a canvas reproduction of that painting in the show in Asheville. Ah. But that was a very proud moment for me that, you know, John Wetton had some of my artwork hanging up in his home. But he was a wonderful man, and I surely miss him.
And in terms of vocalists, I mean, you've obviously worked with some incredible vocalists over the time, but John's voice was just something special, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. You know, he was... he was almost like this crooner with this big classical booming voice that then he just figured out how to put into rock and roll and did very uniquely so, because there aren't many, if any, other rock singers that sound like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking of incredible vocalists, someone else on your resume I need to ask you about. I need to ask what, how, and when. It says Freddie Mercury. Explain.
Yeah. After Freddie had passed away, it was discovered there was a fair amount of unfinished recordings that he had done. And those recordings were given to a handful of record producers in Los Angeles. Oh, here's another Ron Nevison tie-in. It was Ron Nevison who called me one day and said, hey, I have this Freddie Mercury song that is going to be part of a tribute album, and I need to finish it off. So, you know, do you want to play on it? And I said, of course. You know, I loved Queen growing up. I saw them in concert many times. And I went to a recording studio in Los Angeles, and my drums were set up in the big room, you know, to get the big ambient sound. And I was the only one there. And I'm sitting at the drums with a pair of headphones. And what I'm hearing is a recording of Freddie playing piano and singing. And I just kind of played along with it. And it was this otherworldly, magical experience. Because I kind of felt like it was just me and him in this room. It was really unbelievable. Once the drums were done, then they added one by one guitar, bass guitar, some orchestral strings and things. It turned into a very beautiful song that is called In My Defense. And that's online. People can hear that song if they like. And the name of the album is The Great Pretender. And so even though I never met Freddie, to have the good fortune to you know, be on a record where you can hear my drumming and his singing is pretty amazing thing.
That's absolutely amazing indeed. And just talking about some of your other resume, too many to mention, like John Fogerty and Jolyn Turner, who we've had on the show recently as well, and things like that. But let's move on to Lynyrd Skynyrd then, where we began. I mean, you're on tour at the moment with ZZ Top, the Sharp-Dressed Simple Man Tour, a brilliant name. Just tell us a little bit about this tour and where did that name come from? Whoever dreamt that up was fantastic.
I wish I could take credit for the name, yeah. But, you know, they combined Sharp-Dressed Man and Simple Man, and there you are. The tour is going wonderfully well. It is a co-headliner tour, and what's great about this tour is there's enough common thread. You know, they're two classic rock-era bands. A lot of the fans that love ZZ, love Skynyrd. So people are very, very happy to come to this event. And we have toured many, many times in the past. In fact, my very first tour with Skynyrd, which was back in 1999, was a double bill tour with ZZ Top. And to go back even further than that, I've known the ZZ Top guys since Damn Yankee days. Because they used to come out and see Damn Yankees play. So, you know, everyone in the two camps are all great old friends. We're having a great time on this tour. We've been working the entire month of March, and we're working all of April. And then we go off on our own for a bit, and then we pick up again all of August, all of September, working together. And it's a great night of music, and we're having a great time doing it. And I should mention what has become very fun. We've only done it now for about a week, but Billy Gibbons, the brilliant, iconic guitarist of ZZ Top, is getting up on stage with Lynyrd Skynyrd and playing Call Me the Breeze.
Oh, very cool.
And the crowd goes crazy when that happens.
I can imagine. Yeah. And as you said there, your first tour with Lynyrd Skynyrd was 1999. That's a quarter of a century ago, which is pretty insane to think. I mean, how did you become involved with Lynyrd Skynyrd? Was it Ron Nevison?
It was Ron Nevison.
Oh, wow.
I think I need to send him a fruit basket. At this point.
Fairy godmother, yeah.
Truly. Lynyrd Skynyrd and Damn Yankees actually shared the stage a few times in the early 90s. So I've known the Skynyrd guys socially a long, long time. And in 1998, Tommy Shaw had recorded a solo album. And he asked me to play on that album, which I did. Seven Deadly Zens is the name of that album. And the drummer from Styx, the brilliant Todd Circleman, and I shared drumming duties on that album. Okay. Tommy had the opportunity to go out and tour for a few weeks to support that record. So he asked me to do the tour. The tour was opening for Lynyrd Skynyrd. So unbeknownst to me, as we're doing that tour, the Skynyrd band members are watching our show thinking, oh, you know, that's the kind of drummer we want for the band. I knew none of this. However, we finished that tour, Tommy Shaw opening for Lynyrd Skynyrd. And then I get a phone call from Nevison, who says, hey, I'm in the studio. I'm producing a Skynyrd album. You know, I know you know all of these guys, so why don't you just come down to the studio to hang out one day socially, which I did. And that day, Ron said, you know what, we're going to need percussion on this record. which would be the, you know, the frosting on the cake. So the tambourine and the cowbell and all the little last minute, you know, sweetening that you do. So Ron hired me to play percussion on the record Edge of Forever. And this is then came to me and said, you know what, we're looking for a new drummer. Are you interested? And I was. And 26 years later, here I am. Still.
Incredible stuff. I mean, what is it like then? I mean, because obviously Lynyrd Skynyrd are a heritage band. They've been going for, like you say, 50 years, and they've got some of the biggest classic rock anthems going, and you're there playing that stuff for the last 20 years, and the fans are lapping it up. What's it like to be part of a band like that then?
It's wonderful. You know, I should mention, Paul, that I, as a 13-year-old kid, was playing in bands with other school friends, literally playing Gimme Three Steps, Freebird. So none of this is lost on me. I realize how lucky, fortunate, blessed I've been to, you know, fast forward a bunch of years, I'm actually in the band and I'm playing Freebird in front of 20,000 people right across the street in a few hours. And it's been an amazing experience to play this music that has stood the test of time, that is part of, here in America, it's part of our pop culture. You know, Sweet Home Alabama, Freebird. I mean, these are iconic songs. And, you know, to be able to do this, it's so wonderful. And last year we lost Gary Rossington, yeah. Rest in peace. Gary was the last original member. So there are not any original members in the band now. However, I've been there 26 years. Johnny Van Zant, the younger brother of Ronnie, has now been singing in the band 37 years. Ricky Medlock, the brilliant guitarist, has been in the band 28 years in this era, but was in the original band in the early days playing drums when they were still playing clubs and recording demos. So we have enough of a through line, I think, from the band's early days to now, that that I feel that we, with integrity, are carrying the torch and keeping the music and all those wonderful people alive that created it.
Absolutely. And as you say, you've got 20,000 people coming to see you every night and things like that. So the music is still there. It's still loved. But does it hurt? Do you get offended when people say things like it's just a tribute band now because it's not the original members?
No, I don't, because we are paying tribute to the band. And, you know, when I joined the band in 1998, there were three original members in the band: Billy Powell, Gary Rossington, and Leon Wilkinson. And, you know, with a band that goes back that long, sadly, you know, people are going to pass away, and replacements are unfortunately going to have to step in. ZZ Top, who we're playing with tonight, they lost Dusty Hill, their bass player. And so now you have Frank Beard, the drummer, and Billy Gibbons, the guitarist from the original band, but Dusty, rest in peace, is gone. But they are carrying on their legacy. They continue to play just as we did. So, you know, when I joined the band about 2 years later, Leon Wilkinson passed away. But the band continued on and we brought in someone to play bass. And then another 8 or 9 years later, Billy Powell passed away. But the band continued on and we found a new piano player. And then last year, Gary passed away, and we found another guitarist But this only happened because the estates of all of the former original members wanted us to continue and wanted us to keep the music and these wonderful people alive. So I do not blame anyone out there that feels, well, that's not the original band, that's just a tribute band. That's fine. You know, they're entitled to that. It's the people that are coming out to still see us play who are loving the music and still appreciating the fact that we're keeping the music alive. And I'm happy and I'm appreciative to them for doing so.
Absolutely. Well, Michael, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you for this last 40 minutes or so. Thank you so much for your time. A quick reminder, your exhibition, your art exhibition, May 25th in North Carolina, Asheville, I believe it is. Looking forward to seeing more from Lynyrd Skynyrd. And you're out on the road, as you said, with ZZ Top, still touring throughout the year. So if you get the chance to go and see these two incredible bands, if they pass near you, then definitely go and see them. And again, we cross our fingers and hope that maybe the Damn Yankees can find somewhere within the calendar where they can get together and do something new, because I'm sure we'd all love to see that.
And when that happens, you and I will do another interview.
We certainly will, Michael. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Paul.
There you go, Michael Cartellone there. Again, if you're in Asheville or that kind of area, then please do head along to Michael's exhibition. And I'm guessing you'll probably get to meet the man himself, which would be very, very cool. May the 25th, that is Asheville, North Carolina. But that's it for this week's episode. Make sure to subscribe to VRP Rocks on your podcast app. Check out the VRP Rocks YouTube channel as well. Past 5.5 million views, which is crazy. And on all the social media channels as well. Just search for VRP Rocks pretty much everywhere and you'll be able to find us. And that's it for this week's episode. So until next week's, take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.